The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivalled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Welcome to Holy Smoke, the Spectator's religion podcast. I'm Damian Thompson. Next Wednesday, the Cardinal Electors of the Catholic Church will process into the Sistine Chapel to begin the conclave to elect a successor to Pope Francis. And as you might imagine, not only Rome, but the entire church is in a state of fevered excitement. It normally is when a pope dies and a conclave takes place, but this time round, I think I'm right in saying that it's regarded as one of the most consequential conclaves for centuries, and there is a very hard-fought battle between, if not cardinals, then the supporters of certain cardinals, to see whether Pope Francis's controversial legacy will be preserved, amended, or ditched. And I'm joined today by somebody who can probably tell us more than anything else about the state of play and whose judgment, as I know from, 30 years of friendship, is beyond reproach. This is Luke Coppen of The Pillar, who was the best editor of the Catholic Herald in its history and, unlike me, does not play with hyperbole. So, Luke, do you agree that the atmosphere is rather feverish at the moment?
Yes, I do. Absolutely. For the reasons that you mentioned, with the legacy of Pope Francis being shaped through this conclave. And I think also, as well, I think that it's not just the Catholic Church that's looking at what's going to be happening, but many non-Catholics around the world are following this with more closely than they have done, I think, for any conclave that I can remember. I think this is gripping people's imagination far beyond the church.
And why is that, do you think?
I think perhaps partly because of Pope Francis's outreach to people outside the church and his effort to communicate with them. And I think he did grab people's attention through his gestures and through his remarks. And I think that the consequence of that is that a lot more people are looking on now to see who his successor will be.
I think there's still a sense among the general public that Francis was the good pope, the friendly pope, the people's pope, and that conservatives are trying to undermine his achievements. I look at it very differently. I know you look at it differently, though, perhaps not in such stark terms as I do. But I wonder if you could give me some idea, before we mention any papabile cardinals, of what might broadly be seen as the strands of opinion or camps in the Catholic Church at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's, as you say, this is quite a complicated question, and you can look at it in many different ways, I think, depending on the prism that you're looking through. And there are several of those prisms that are quite important to understand how the cardinals divide on issues. And one of them, as we said, is the legacy of Pope Francis, in itself a massive question with so many different facets to it. Do the cardinals believe that Pope Francis overall was his legacy is broadly positive? Do they feel it was broadly negative? It's often said that a certain proportion of the College of Cardinals believes that this pontificate, although outwardly successful perhaps, was confusing and disorientating, and they may see this conclave as a chance to remedy that. There are other prisms. Another one would be the sexual abuse scandal, which continues to overshadow the Catholic Church, even though it didn't feature very much in the media coverage during Pope Francis' pontificate. The issue hasn't gone away at all, and there are profound questions about how, within the church, about how that issue should be dealt with and how far Pope Francis has gone or not gone in tackling this issue.
So indeed, how you know, what active role he played in shielding a string of sex offenders, as I never cease to point out and will carry on pointing out until it's properly covered by the media. So we've got doctrinal confusion, and I think it's hard for liberals or conservatives or moderates to argue that there aren't grey areas that didn't exist before. And I don't intend this to be a sort of post-mortem on the Francis pontificate, but you know, there are questions that haven't been dealt with, such as, is it okay for divorced and remarried people to receive Holy Communion? Is it okay for gay couples to be blessed? Doctrinal questions about the uniqueness of Christ and the role of Christ in salvation seem to have been muddied somewhat by some of the Pope's more confusing statements. The question of the environment, the very high priority that Francis gave to saving the planet, according to the prescriptions of certain rather partisan lobby groups, you might say. But a confusion about the role of the Pope, the unity of the Catholic Church, the role of the laity, and the role of the bishop. All of these things seem to have become very jumbled up, particularly we look at this horrible buzzword, synodality. We had a series of very confusing conferences in which left-wing activists were invited to moan on and pursue their hobby horses. And then Francis slightly pulled the rug from underneath them by saying they weren't allowed to describe a big issue I should have mentioned earlier, for example, whether women could become deacons. But if we look at the leading candidates, insofar as we know, and we're always guessing, I mean, I've been looking at, there's a brilliant book by Andrew Greeley, The Making of the Popes, published in 1978, in which he puts on one side the speculation in the press and his own thoughts at the time, and then what actually happened, and the mismatch is really dramatic. Mm. But different cardinals take different views on matters. So if we could just talk about a few papabile cardinals, because nobody can disagree that they're papabile. They may not be actually in the running, but they're seen as papabile. They may not be in the running in the secret negotiations. There, some of them may have fallen by the wayside already. I'm sure some of them have. Some of them may be stronger than we think. Some of them may be weaker than we think. But perhaps we can begin with the man who, to my intense dismay, is often spoken of as the front runner, which is Cardinal Pietro Parolin, the Secretary of State, chiefly famous among those who care for signing a deal with the Chinese Communist Party, which gave, and I'm not sure this was the intention, but it was certainly the outcome, the Communist Party total control over the appointment of bishops, a betrayal of the Communist Party of Cardinal Joseph Zen, who's been attending, he's too old to vote, but attending the pre-conclave congregations, described as an utter betrayal and accused Parolin of lying. But Parolin was Secretary of State for the entire reign of Francis, which is quite surprising because Francis liked sacking people. And given the controversies attached to his name, why is he perceived as a front runner?
Well, I think it's because of his overall persona, which, as you say, the China deal looms very large in that, and he was the sort of intellectual architect of that deal, if it was Pope Francis, though, that signed it and agreed to it overall. I think it's that he's so familiar to other members of the College of Cardinals in a way that other cardinals aren't, because the College itself hasn't met that often during the Pope Francis pontificate. So the cardinals don't really know each other, but everybody knows who Cardinal Parolin is. And almost everyone, every cardinal who goes to visit the Vatican will meet and press the flesh of Cardinal Parolin. And they do so in impressive circumstances, in grand rooms. And they're, in many ways, they've seen him as a figure who moderated some of Pope Francis's more undiplomatic off-the-cuff comments. Parolin was often there to try and douse out some fires that Pope Francis had inadvertently set through his comments on international relations. So perhaps in their mind, Parolin is a reliable figure, someone they know, someone they feel that therefore they may be able to trust, perhaps even despite the misgivings that they may have about the China deal or confusion about what's happening there. So I think that's one reason why he's right at the front and centre of all the conversation about the papabile at the moment.
And has a reputation for being personally charming. I mean, I remember being astonished receiving a phone call from somebody who is a sworn enemy of Pope Francis, and a very influential one, who'd received, during his war with Francis, had received friendly phone calls from Parolin, who was very keen to keep on his good side. And this guy was saying, to my astonishment, he's not that bad, you know, you might be surprised. And I was saying, he is that bad. Because don't forget that in addition to signing the noxious China deal, And it was under his stewardship that the Secretariat of State squandered hundreds of millions of dollars on crazy, criminally tainted property deals.
Yeah,
but
yes.
Charming, you know, people say, I haven't met him, no desire to meet him, but charming and self-effacing, but knows how to wear a mitre and makes bloody sure that he does wear, you know, the mitre, because one of the things we've seen him doing is pushing, during Francis's illness, he made damn sure that he appeared to be sort of deputy pope, which the Secretary of State is not, but nonetheless, he behaved as if he was deputy pope. Didn't look convincing to me because I think he sucks, but I think it looked convincing to a lot of Catholics watching him lead prayers for Francis or saying this or that mass he muddled in on, saying the mass of John Paul II and all sorts of things. Am I hinting at my opinion of him, Luke?
No, I think you may be here. I mean, he is I think promising a degree of stability if he were to be elected. I think judging from his behaviour over the past few weeks, he's as you say, he's cropped up all over the place, and he's handled all these events of aplomb. You know, he's been meeting world leaders like Zelensky, been photographed doing that on the day of the Pope's funeral. Everything that he does sends a message that he's capable, that he's calm, and perhaps that as a Pope, he would be bringing a bit of serenity to an office that's been quite turbulent over the past 12 years.
He won't bring much serenity to one wing of the church if he maintains his opposition to the traditional Latin Mass, will he?
Yes, this is an extremely divisive point within the Catholic Church, and it does appear, at least it's been widely rumoured, that Cardinal Parolin is strongly in favour of the crackdown that was launched on the Tridentine Mass under Pope Francis. But he hasn't really spoken on the record, to the best of my knowledge, about it, perhaps carefully avoiding any sort of track record.
I wonder if it's possible if during the conclave people think, well, he's probably going to get elected. Some conservatives might say, we'll give you your support so long as you ease up on the restrictions on the Latin Mass, which caused such distress. And he might decide that, you know, Rome is worth a Tridentine Mass, so to speak.
It's possible. Everything's possible, I think, when those doors close. And
let's talk about the other candidate who's most discussed at the moment. Well, actually, that's not quite... that's Cardinal Pizzaballa, Patriarch of Jerusalem. Let's get something out of the way first. For a few days, the most discussed cardinal was Cardinal Serra, former prefect of the Congregation for Divine Worship. And the sort of hardline traditionalists on social media, on Twitter and on YouTube, got very excited about the prospect. But, you know, he's 79 years old. If Francis had lived another 6 weeks or something, he wouldn't have been eligible. He would have been a cardinal elector. And he has said some very controversial things in the past. He's a great scholar, and I think we'd probably make a very good pope, perhaps. But a pope needs a two-thirds majority. He needs 89 votes. Is there an alternative universe in which Cardinal Serra gets 89 votes?
I mean, this does raise the question of an African pope, which is being one of the widely discussed talking points at the moment. But of course, Serra isn't the only candidate, the African candidate, and there is another serious one, I'd argue, Cardinal Ambongo, who's the Archbishop of Kinshasa, who I think has been a member of the Pope's Council of Cardinal Advisors, who could give Serra or anyone else a fair run for their money, I think, at this conclave.
Where does he stand on various issues?
Well, I think he would stand in pretty much the same camp as Cardinal Serra, given that he led the resistance to the same-sex blessings document, Fiducia Supplicans, and managed to secure, I think quite remarkably, kind of African opt-out on that document. So I think he's just been catapulted to prominence in the global church thanks to that episode. And I think he has a interesting backstory as someone who's also offered quite bold resistance to the powers that be in his country, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And I think people will be at least giving him a look at this conclave.
What about other cardinals from, well, we call them the peripheries? It's a bit silly to talk about these huge populous nations as peripheries, but there's a South Korean cardinal, isn't there, who's taken seriously by some?
Yes, that's right. He was, until the Pope's death, the head of the Dicastery for Clergy, Cardinal Lazaro Suk. Sorry, Dame, I'm going to have to just double check the pronunciation of his name because forgive me here. Cardinal Lazaro Yu Hung Sik, or Cardinal Yu. And yes, he's a really widely respected figure, a gentle kind of pastoral figure who's also been pretty effective, I believe, in his role as a Vatican prefect. However, there doesn't seem to be the similar kind of buzz around him as there has been around other Asian cardinals, like Cardinal Tagle, for example, who's sort of omnipresent in papabile lists. So I would see Cardinal Yu as a kind of dark horse character. But he does come from the very strong South Korean church, Catholic church, and people don't, I think even Catholics don't quite realize just how lively the church is in South Korea and how influential it is there, despite its minority status.
Well, let's talk about Cardinal Chito Tagle. A couple of years ago, he was kind of in disgrace. He'd been made head of Caritas, which is the church's largest charity, and then demoted humiliatingly by Francis, who plucked him out of Manila to give him this big job in the Vatican, head of evangelization as well. But now he's been taken in some circles seriously as a candidate, although one Roman source said to me, no chance whatsoever. He's ebullient, he's lachrymose, he likes to dance. Traditionalists shudder at the sight of him gyrating on various stages. He probably doesn't like the Latin Mass. He's a good communicator. I suspect, a holy man. Do you rate his chances?
I think again, he's. You have to take him seriously in the conclave conversation. I think because of the things that you've mentioned, those qualities, I suppose above all his sort of personal qualities of being a charismatic speaker who can connect with audiences, and his sort of ever smiling personality. These are pretty useful things when you're a pope. Although intellectually, people might think, I've heard people say that they think he's a lightweight, but if you look at his academic track record, it's actually pretty good, I'd say, for a cardinal. It's quite decent. He can hold his own intellectually, I believe, in the College of Cardinals. Others would disagree with that. And as you say, things like his propensity for karaoke, yeah, it doesn't, perhaps it won't resonate very much with the College of Cardinals, but it does outside. People kind of love that he has this sort of quirky characteristics. Now, it's an interesting question of whether he's sort of on the up or on the down in Vatican terms at the moment. And I'd say that's really quite, it was very confusing at the end of the Francis Pontificate about whether he was in favour or out of favour. And my reading of it was that he fell out of favour at a certain point, but for mysterious reasons was kind of rehabilitated and resumed quite a prominent position at the Vatican's Dicastery for Evangelization, which is supposedly the flagship Dicastery of the Vatican after Pope Francis's reforms of the Curia. So I think he's serious. I think he's someone to look at.
Okay. Let's talk about conservatives. We hear two names mentioned, clearly conservative. One of them is Cardinal, let me get this right, Wim Eyck.
Yes.
From the Netherlands, a medical doctor who became a priest and obviously a cardinal. I can't think of any other cardinal who criticized Francis so openly for his flakiness on doctrine. What do we make of him? A lot of people say they're impressed by him.
Yes, they do. And it's interesting that the people saying that are those who are outside the Netherlands, because the Netherlands, or at least the Netherlands, the Catholic media in the Netherlands seems to be quite largely kind of critical of him. I think perhaps because it comes from quite a liberal standpoint. So yeah, not so, he's not so esteemed in his country, it seems, but outside, particularly in the UK, his thoughts on bioethics, on euthanasia, assisted suicide, are listened to really carefully. And he's really articulate on these questions. He's a real expert on this. And it was said that this week that he gave a speech that really resonated to the cardinals during their general congregation meetings, which they're holding daily at the moment in Rome. So I don't know whether he's a candidate or one of the leading candidates, but he's certainly someone who is when he speaks, people are listening to him. And I've yet to see evidence that he's sort of developing a momentum as a candidate. But I mean, let's watch out and see what happens.
Yeah. Let's talk about somebody who's invariably mentioned as a candidate of the Conservatives, which is Cardinal Peter Erdő of Hungary. He's a canonist. I've met him. Dignified, self-effacing, rather shy, perhaps a bit prickly and dour sometimes. But I remember gave a big speech at one of those wretched synods of Francis, and basically appeared tremendously magisterial and papal all of a sudden, warning the synod not to, you know, not to overstep its remit or something along those lines. Some people say he's not papabile, he hasn't got what it takes, not an ounce of charisma, just not inspiring enough. Others say, don't underestimate him. What do you think?
Yeah, I think don't underestimate him, because in fact, the Cardinals may be looking for a more boring, dependable figure this time round after the incredible non-stop drama of the Francis pontificate. So his dullness may be a good, maybe an attractive quality at this moment. And as you say, I think particularly his skill at canon law, church law, will be important, because critics of Pope Francis accused him in his lifetime of muddying the law, of confusing things, of making the law of the church unusable. And that has quite serious consequences in the life of the church. So I think such people would see Erdo as the solution to that, the guy who could bring everything together again in a coherent system of law, and ensure that the law, in their view, was applied throughout the church on a kind of fair and just basis. So I think that's what's attractive about him. I do think there are questions about his relationship with the Hungarian authorities, particularly, I mean, the Orban regime, which the church and state are very entangled there in Hungary. And at least Erdo's critics would say that he hasn't distanced himself sufficiently from some of the worst aspects of the Orban regime. Erdo's supporters would dismiss that as nonsense.
Which leaves my candidate, for what it's worth, which is zero, which is Cardinal Pete Sabala, the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, an Italian who has lived outside Italy for
30 years, I think.
30 years now, who's been custodian of the holy places, a tremendously dignified, quite serious, though sometimes witty, extremely clever, fluent English, fluent Hebrew, Franciscan scholar with definitely a quiet charisma about him, attached to neither left nor right, has not said, you know, is orthodox as far as we know. And it's difficult to judge the orthodoxy of some of the candidates. Perhaps I should say in parenthesis, as far as we know, on paper, Parolin is more orthodox than some of the candidates. But, I've left one out. That was inevitable. I'll come to him in a second. But go back to Pete Sabala.
Yes.
There's a lot of excitement about him online, as you were pointing out to me earlier. The question is whether this excitement is replicated inside the congregations. I hope it is, because I think he's the man the church needs. Mm.
But from what I've heard so far, it hasn't. The internet excitement hasn't translated yet into a similar buzz among the cardinals. And that could be because of his age. I believe he's about 60, which would mean that he could be Pope for a couple of decades. And that there's a big, big question of whether the Cardinals would want someone who would be in post for that long. So I think that could be a reason why he's not getting a similar amount of attention over in Rome at the moment. However, you know, he is an internationally prominent figure ever since he made that comment in which he offered, after the October 7th attacks on Israel, he offered to be exchanged for Israeli hostages, particularly women and children. And he made that offer to Hamas, and this made headlines all over the world. Obviously, Hamas didn't respond in any way to him. It didn't go any further than that. But I think that gesture really put him on the map. I don't think he was intending that to happen, but it was just such a powerful gesture that he's immediately sort of gained a whole lot of new attention. And he's been living through an utter crisis, as we know, since the October the 7th attacks, in a extremely difficult environment. He has sort of held his own, and he has helped to keep the Catholic community alive in Gaza and throughout the whole Holy Land region. Has given a lot of support to people. Despite all these challenges, he has, you know, kept his head above the water, and that is very, very impressive. But whether that will translate into other cardinals seeing him as the next pope, I don't know.
I mean, he's 60. Yeah, it is young for a pope, though. It's not as young as John Paul II.
Yes.
I mean, look, nobody's perfect. Nobody's going to tick every box.
No.
If that's the blackest mark against him, when you consider how many black marks there are against my friend Barolin.
Yes.
Doesn't amount to very much. I'm missing out another Italian candidate, perhaps seen as a sort of secondary possibility, but that's Cardinal Matteo Zuppi of Bologna, whom I rather like, who's left wing. I've called him the bicycling beanpole. Seems to be, I was told by a traditionalist, he's a very holy man with a great commitment to the poor, influenced by the Sant'Egidio community, which is a left wing community stroke pressure group that not everybody approves of. I happen to know one of the leading cardinals we've just mentioned. Can't stand them, I suspect more. But I'm not sure that he is their candidate. Sympathetic to the Tridentine Mass, he taught himself to say it under Benedict and has presided in Tridentine Vespers under Francis, which was quite brave of him.
Yeah.
What do you make of Matteo Zuppi? Do you like him?
Yeah, I like him a lot. I think he's a charismatic figure. I think he has a gift for peacemaking as well. And I think you can see that going way back in his history to the 1990s, when he helped to broker an end to the Mozambican civil war, which had lasted about 15 years and killed about a million people. And he was one of the four people who was heavily involved in the dialogue. And people credit him with keeping those peace talks on going, even when they were sort of falling apart, that they say that he went the sort of extra mile to try and get a resolution, which there was in the end. So I think he has this gift for peacemaking that Pope Francis saw also when the Pope asked him to go to Ukraine and to Russia, to China and to America to try and see what could be done to, if not end the Ukraine war, then to at least achieve some kind of humanitarian breakthrough. And Zuppi faithfully carried out that mission. And arguably, when he got us no closer to an end to the war, but he did secure the release of quite a lot of soldiers who were being held as prisoners of war. So I don't believe that mission was entirely unsuccessful, as some people would argue. And as you say, within the church itself, he has sort of made some sort of gestures of moderation. He seems to be liked in a lot of different quarters, though not all. And
traditionalists have got one particular beef against him, which is that he permitted a gay blessing ceremony to take place in one of his churches, and then when questioned about it, I don't know if it was him or his office, but were very economical with the truth about that, and the trads always bring this up. And I mean, how much of a problem is that for him, do you think?
Well, I think the publication of Fiducia Supplicans, the document on same-sex blessing, has made maybe sort of taken a bit of steam out of that criticism. I think we're sort of in a changed world now in terms of the same-sex blessings debate. And I believe that Zuppi welcomed the document Fiducia Supplicans, but he isn't sort of associated with it.
I think he kept out of the controversy.
Yeah, I think he did put up. I think he has said it was a good thing, but I don't think he's. I don't think he's got into a debate about it. He hasn't made it a central issue by any means. And something about him as well worth noting is that he's very, very omnipresent on the Italian kind of cultural circuit. That wherever there's a sort of book launch or a debate or something like that, you often see him sort of sitting, kind of slouching in a chair there on the stage, giving his opinions about cultural matters and church life and so on. So he's someone who's at ease in outside church circles on a public stage. He's very comfortable with it.
The gay blessings subject, I think, will loom very, very large in the cardinals' deliberations. Only a few cardinals, I think, have unambiguously come out in favour of that. And that's the kiss of death for a candidate. So I think on the one hand, you can say hardline conservatives, I think Taylor Marshall counted, 18 of them. So, and they would include maybe Sarah and Muller and Ranjit, I don't know. But they have no hope of getting two-thirds of the vote because, 80% of the cardinals were appointed by Francis, so they just haven't got the numbers. But neither have the Supiches and Horriches of this world. There's no way that cardinals from the West sympathetic to gay blessings are going to get the votes of sub-Saharan Africans or Asians or people from traditional societies. I mean, there might be one or two exceptions, but it's basically, it blocks them from, you know, somebody more radical than Francis is really, not that Francis was a big campaigner on the gay issue, but somebody more radical than Francis is unlikely. And also anybody who's sympathetic towards this, the way the German church seems to have declared UDI and turned itself into a sort of liberal Protestant church. Any cardinal sympathetic to that, or associated with the sort of extremes of synodality, as it's called, load of waffle, but a very expensive waffle. I think of it as a sort of practical joke that Francis paid on the liberals to. I said it was a sort of bouncy castle for annoying liberals. And but what do you make of all that? The hard left not really being papabile.
Yeah, I think that's plausible after this pontificate that was characterized widely as being sort of leftward tilting. I think it's worth noting, you mentioned the German synodal way. I think it's worth noting that one of the strongest opponents of that movement at the Vatican was Cardinal Parolin, who really pushed back very strongly against it on Pope Francis' behalf. And this was at a point when Pope Francis appeared not to want to be the person who said no to the synodal German sort of radical synodal way. But Parolin seemed to be quite happy to play that role of pushing back on it. So if Parolin is indeed elected Pope, then I think in Germany this will be seen as a very negative sign that they see as their reform movement of the church, born out of the terrible abuse crisis that they had there, but which many people outside Germany feel has gone completely off the rails.
Yeah, I don't know how I'll handle it if Parolin walks, because I'll be there probably. I don't know how I'll handle it if he walks out onto the balcony. I mean, there are many liberals I prefer to him. I know it's a bit of a hobby horse of mine, but I do think that the traditional mass is an incredibly important subject, because the attempt to suppress the spirituality of the traditional mass, which really does appeal to young people, seems to me like an attempt to strangle at birth a real spiritual revival within the church. One that, of course, like any fervent movement, can get out of hand. But that's the job of the church, to make sure it doesn't get out of hand. Traditionis Custodes and that wretched old snobbish careerist, you know, my name is coming, Arthur Roach, did so much damage. And for that not to be reversed, I think would be a dreadful sign, because that's where the growth, pretty modest, there are other signs of growth, but that is a very significant form of growth in the church. I mean, the Chartres pilgrimage of young people from Paris to Chartres is it's going to be bigger than ever this
year.
Right. Last year, Cardinal Müller celebrated the old rite, which he's taught himself in recent years for them. If the conclave continues that persecution, I will feel that something horrible, a horrible aberration, has now become institutionally embedded. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there are signs that the cardinals right now are discussing what's happening in France, as sort of, I suppose, more broadly than just the Chartres pilgrimage, which is extraordinary in the growth that it's undergone in the past couple of years. But just more broadly, there's been an upsurge in adult baptisms. I mean, a quite extraordinary upsurge in adult baptisms there, and particularly among young people as well, sort of tilting very much towards children just coming out of secondary school and going on to college and university. There's so many in France who are becoming Catholic, and that's capturing the attention of Catholics worldwide. You know, why is this happening? What's distinctive about the French church? You know, what kind of culture of the church is there, and can we replicate this elsewhere in the Catholic Church?
And how many of them are Tridentine?
I think quite a number. I don't know the exact proportion, but yeah, a significant number. Obviously, not all of them, but it's a strong part of this culture that's developing. And also, as well, raises quite profound questions. Especially, you know, we thought that Europe was secularizing. We kind of concluded that the Catholic Church had lost, in a sense, Europe. But now we're seeing a resurgence here and there. Obviously, not everywhere. Let's not exaggerate it. But you know, what are the elements that are making this revival happen in France? And there are signs of it elsewhere as well, but I think most dramatically in France. And how can the next Pope encourage that elsewhere in the world? I think the cardinals will have to grapple with that, and I think they will be sort of keen to talk about that, because it's not all bad news. It's not all falling numbers.
One of the big surprises has been the tremendous revival of devotion to the Blessed Sacrament in the form of adoration of the Blessed Sacrament. Now, that was virtually dead as a practice. I mean, you know, it was exposed to, you know, briefly during benediction, which most parishes stopped holding. And as you talked about when I was young, adoration being the in thing among young Catholics, people would have looked at you as if you were mad, and you would have been mad as well. But where is that coming from? I know we're slightly off the subject, but it's actually, if the conclave doesn't grapple with this extraordinary thing, which is associated with, but certainly not the same thing as the old rite, because it's certainly bigger than the old rite, where's that coming from and what's the appeal?
Well, it seems that lots of churchmen are interpreting it as a kind of desire for sort of peaceful contemplation among young people. The young people that they meet and encounter and sort of take care of often say that they feel that they're living these kind of very hectic, fragmented, digitally focused lives, and they're desperate for something, for a place or a practice that will help them to sort of leave these stresses behind and give them a kind of direction in life. So the cardinals often speak about it in that way, that Eucharistic adoration is providing this sort of calm, peaceful place in which young people can leave behind the stresses and draw closer to God. Yeah, so I think, and that in a way that is surprising, because it's not what you would have expected, might have expected to cause a kind of revival. You might have expected tele-evangelist style preachers inspiring it or great writers or something like that, as in the past. But now it's more of a sort of decentralized practice that seems to be a central part of this revival, as you say. And
there's, I think, a rather telling contrast between the silence of adoration so attractive to young people and the endless waffling and exchange of platitudes and jargon associated with the oldsters' synodality, which is all about talking, I'd say, in a completely sort of empty and formulaic fashion, agreeing on nothing. Don't you think there's a contrast between the oldsters, being one myself, the oldsters rabbiting on like loonies on the top of the bus, and the young people with their adoration?
There's two sides that I think there is. You know, it does, from the outside, synod on solidarity can be prejudiced as a talking shop. On the other hand, there were really regular breaks for prayer during that whole process. In fact, there were so many breaks of prayer that participants seemed quite sort of, they seemed to be almost complaining about how much they had to pray and how much they couldn't just sort of get on with discussing things. So I think there was quite a lot of prayer in reality. Part of the synod, okay, maybe it's still a talking shop, but there was prayer there. And also I'd say that Pope Francis himself, I think he did encourage adoration in a way, although it wasn't sort of the central part of his spirituality, or it wasn't the sort of the gestures that we remember him for don't really include that, apart from that incredible blessing during the pandemic, the Urbi et Orbi in empty St. Peter's Square.
It always made me forget what a very, very bad pope he was. Interesting, I think that's part of his Latin American heritage, isn't it? And Marian in his devotions.
Yeah, maybe it's just the inspiration of the moment, I don't know, but it just seemed like the right thing at the right time and resonated.
The big picture seems to me, will the cardinal electors be open to changes for which nothing in their formation prepared them, or will they try and hold the fort and talk disingenuously and paradoxically about the reforming and the renewal under Francis, none of which was generated by Francis, I don't think.
I mean, there is a cyclical, I hate to be cynical, but there also is a kind of cyclical quality to these discussions whenever a new pope's elected, because you always have the things that are always there, the abuse crisis, at least in the modern age, Vatican finances being in a terrible state, the need to kind of bring the church's message to non-believers, to an indifferent society and so on. There is this, you know, although the names and the faces change, there are these underlying problems that can never be fully addressed within the Catholic Church and the wider world.
Well, that's true. I'm going to feel very nervous as we hear the words, you know, as when the white smoke goes up, will you?
I'll see when we get there. I don't feel nervous at the moment, but we are quite a long way off.
You've got a stronger faith than I have. And I agree with those people who say it's the most important conclave in living memory. And it's actually not that far off. And by the time this podcast goes out, it will be even closer. And I think listeners will have benefited from those few words I've allowed you to get in. Luke Coppen, as ever, thank you very much indeed.
It's my pleasure, Damien. Good to talk to you.